Good evening, friends, and welcome to lesson number 5 of Booksmart. And tonight, we will be discussing Musar and Jewish philosophy. So, as you know, what we've been doing here for the last 4 weeks, and tonight and next Monday, we have been exploring 3,000 years of Jewish wisdom and Jewish learning. And, of course, we first dealt with the Tanakh, the Bible, then we dealt with the Midrash, then the Talmud. Last week, Halakha, Jewish law. We had a riveting discussion last week, and tonight we move forward on to what we call Jewish ethics and philosophy. Musar means ethics, and the word for philosophy in Hebrew is called Chakira. Chakira comes from the word investigate, like choker vidoresh would mean like investigation. That's chakira, that's philosophy. But there was actually, talking about dating and marriage, there was a yeshiva boy who was getting ready to go on his first date. But you have to realize, growing up in Brooklyn, the only females he ever spoke to in his life were his mother and his sisters. He never had a, you know, things are very... segregated, let's say, positively. They make for much better marriages later in life when there's segregation earlier on. So this one guy went to his friend and he said, "Listen, I'm going on my first date and I really don't know how, you know, how to maybe have some insight for me, especially considering the fact that what happens if there's like an awkward silence? Like, how can I prepare for all this?" So his friend told him, remember to talk about the three F's: family, food, and philosophy. I know. And then, well, okay. So he really studied it for the next few days, and he went on his date. And then the first time there was like an awkward silence, he says, "Tell me, do you have a brother?" And she said, "No." And was silent once again. No one told him they're not supposed to ask yes or no questions. Then he said, "Do you like gefilte fish?" And she said, "No." There goes family and food. Okay. Now for the last one, he said, "Tell me, if you had a brother, do you think you would like gefilte fish?" So, that's what we will be discussing tonight: ethics and philosophy. And, so you know, each one of these are really a category of its own. There is some overlap between ethics and philosophy. That's why it was chosen to put them together in the same evening, in the same class. But they're worthy each of their own class and probably of their own course. But nonetheless, tonight we're going to be discussing both. You get two for the price of one, which a Jew doesn't like a deal. Buy one, get one free. And we will, however, even though they are distinct, we will discover how they also overlap. And we'll find, we'll have a fascinating discussion towards the end of tonight's class and find a common theme in both. So first we're going to be discussing the fields of ethics and philosophy. We're going to be talking about the specific works. Again, each one has its own library, its own objectives, its own history, each one of these two genres. So in the first part of today's lesson, we'll discuss them and understand them and appreciate them. And then in the second half of tonight's lesson, as we've become accustomed to doing, we'll actually study some Jewish philosophy and Jewish ethics. But we begin with the question: does Judaism even need a philosophy? Why is it even necessary to have a philosophy or a psychology? Why is that? Why the question? Because Torah seems to focus primarily on our behavior and less on how we think and feel. So the question is, why are we worried about it? Isn't Torah a book basically of laws, of guidance, of instruction, of do's and don'ts? So do what you have to do, don't do what you shouldn't do, and that's it. Who needs a philosophy? Who needs a psychology? We're not worried about what you think and what you feel. When you're driving down the street and you're coming to a stop sign, what does the stop sign say?
Stop.
It just says stop. It doesn't ask you if you feel like stopping. It just tells you what to do. Right now you need to stop. So if Judaism needs you to eat matzah on Passover, then eat matzah on Passover. That's not so recommended the rest of the year. Just kidding. You can eat it the whole year too, but most certainly you have an obligation on Passover. And if it's do not steal, then say do not steal. What does it matter what I feel? And if I'm feeling up to not stealing, or if I'm feeling like stealing, or whatever else the particular deed on hand may be. Why are we worried about our mind and how we think and how we feel? So you would think that Judaism doesn't even need it. However, the truth is that Judaism is very concerned about our heart and mind as well. It's not just about what we do. Because, yes, of course it's great to do the right thing. And ultimately, the deed is the main thing. And that's what it boils down to. And as long as I am doing the right thing, then I'm pretty much okay. However, it is also possible, you know, sometimes somebody may be able to get themselves to do the right thing, but not always are you going to win if the fight is all the way up to the deed, meaning I don't understand why I should do this, I don't feel like doing the right thing now. Okay, so let's say most of the time I get it done right, but if it's only the deed that I'm getting done, then I may fail, or it's definitely more possible for me to fail if it's only about doing it right. Because it's very difficult to have that fight every single time I'm confronted by that particular temptation or whatever. That's why we have to do some work behind the scenes and consider how we think and consider how we feel about certain things. Can anyone here think of any commandments in the Torah which are beyond actions, like how we should think or how we should feel?
Don't covet.
Covet, yep, that's in the heart. It doesn't say don't steal your neighbor's car. I mean, stealing is a separate one, but it says not to covet it. So that's in the heart, correct. What else?
Number two.
What's that?
Number two, about idol worship.
Mm-hmm. No other gods?
No other gods.
Okay. What about the first?
Well, that is that there's one God and there isn't anyone else. That's sort of a fact, if you will.
Well, it's more of a statement. Yeah.
And the second one is how you feel and how you think and how you, it's more philosophy.
The beginning of the Shema.
I would say both, but yes, correct. The beginning of the Shema. You mean the first verse of Shema, or do you mean what comes right after?
So you meant
after the first verse of Shema, but you're absolutely right. You should love the Lord your God. Love is in our heart. And what about loving other your fellow?
Nah. Don't bear false witness.
So that too. Is in your heart. Love your fellow. Love God. Fear of God. These are all emotional commandments that we've been touching upon here. So obviously Judaism is very concerned not only with what we do or don't do, but also with what we think and what we feel. And great answers, everybody. And I think the slide even agrees with all of you. Example of non-action Torah precepts. Love your fellow as yourself. Avoid overindulgence in materialism. That's a good one. So in the portion of Kedoshim in the book of Leviticus, how does it open? It says you should sanctify yourself. What does it mean to sanctify yourself? It's not a commandment. But what it means is, and Nachmanides discusses it there at length, famously, he says that even things that you are permitted to do, like let's say, for example, kosher foods. You can eat all you want of kosher food, right? But does that mean that you should eat all you want or all you can eat?
No.
Not necessarily. You should sanctify yourself with what's permitted to you. Because if somebody is overindulgent with what's permitted to them, based on what Nachmanides describes there, somebody could be what he calls in Hebrew a naval birshut haTorah. They can be like a glutton with permission from the Torah. Because as long as the food's kosher, they're not doing anything wrong. That's why it says sanctify yourself. You need to control yourself and know how much of even the kosher thing, how much of it you should have, and you got to know where the stop sign is and where it crosses over into unhealthy. So that's another example of a non-action commandment to sanctify yourself. Avoid overindulgence in materialism where it's permitted, where it's prohibited. We're not even talking about that. Obviously, it's a prohibition. Where it's permitted, we need to curb our enthusiasm. And number three, cultivate traits of joy and trust. There is a commandment in the Torah. Well, there's a verse in Psalm 100, where it says, serve God with joy. What is joy? Joy is not an action. Joy is a feeling in your heart to feel upbeat, to feel spirited, to feel positive. In fact, in there's two places in the Torah where there's a whole list of the opposite of blessings, we'll call them. And it says over there at the end that all this is coming, or potentially, God forbid, coming as a result of not serving God with joy. That's why these would come on people. So the point I want to make is that joy is a very important one, and that too is in the heart. And trust as well, and we'll come back to trust actually a little bit later tonight. So far so good. So it's clear that Judaism is concerned, and we have all these commandments that do help us develop the right mind frame and also the right feelings in our heart. Let's actually read what Maimonides has to say about this in text number one. Lynn, would you like to open up for us? This is Maimonides in his Laws of Repentance, chapter 7.
Do not think that the teshuva repentance is only for sinful actions. Persons should also examine their negative character traits: anger, hatred, envy, frivolity, the pursuit of money and honor, gluttony, etc., and do teshuvah for them as well.
There you go. So Maimonides tells us that the Torah is contains this whole area of musar, which is ethics and character development, and it is a key part of cultivating proper values. So, with that, we see clearly that ethics and character development is an important part of Judaism. What about philosophy? I think I shared with you recently about a new rabbi that came to a synagogue. Yeah? And he was introduced. It was his first Shabbat. And after services, one of the children in the synagogue went over to him and wanted to meet him. And the rabbi said, I'm Rabbi Dr. Goldenberg. So he said to the rabbi, what kind of doctor are you? What does a kid know? You know, he goes to the doctor when he has a cold. He said, actually, I'm a doctor of philosophy. So the kid says, what kind of krenk is that? Krenk means illness in Yiddish. So the question is, yes, ethics does have a place, but what about philosophy? What is the objective in philosophy? If it's just philosophizing, okay, we understand that there, you know, that more often than not, Jews are a smart group of people, and they like to appreciate and understand things. So, and that's all good. But why is it necessary for Judaism to have a philosophy of its own? In other words, Jews can philosophize, but does that mean that their philosophizing or their philosophy needs to be part of Torah? Why does Torah have to have a whole section of philosophy? Maybe people are welcome to philosophize, but it doesn't mean that it needs to be part of Torah. But that is not the case. In fact, philosophy, as we are going to discover tonight, is a whole genre within Torah and within Jewish learning. So we will be hearing a lot more about it soon. But as we kind of mentioned, it's important to for Judaism to offer us a full, all-encompassing philosophy in order to cultivate our mind as well. And what's the reason for that? Because we say in the prayer called Aleinu, Aleinu L'Shabeach, towards the end of that segment, most of you already aren't singing by the time we get to that line, but it goes with by V'yadaita Hayom V'hashevota El. Anyone? Livavecha. V'yadaita Hayom V'hashevota El Livavecha. That's actually the opening words to text number 2. What does that mean? Larry, take it away, please. This is from one of the Jewish philosophers, Rabbi Yeshayahu Horowitz.
The Torah states, "Know today and bring unto your heart that God is the God. That is to say, know God and an in-depth knowledge and with logical proofs in addition to the tradition received from our ancestors." This is alluded to in the verse, "Know the God of your fathers," meaning to say, in addition to the faith established in your heart by your fathers, by the tradition handed down through the generations, you should also know on your own by meaning of your own understanding. This is also alluded to in verse Exodus 15:2. "This is my God, and I shall beautify him, the God of my fathers, and I shall exalt him." That is to say, when he is my God, due to my own knowledge and understanding, then, Bahavna, I shall beautify him, which can also be read as a combination of the words Ani Vahu, I and he, as Rashi explains in his commentary on the Talmud, meaning I and he are bonded together, so to speak, because my knowledge of him is internalized in my heart. However, when I do not possess a knowledge of God that is the product of my understanding, only the tradition that he is the God of my fathers, then I shall exalt him. God remains aloof and elevated from me, and I am distant from him in the inner recesses of my heart.
Pause right there. Whatever this text has is covered. So let's just talk about this for a minute. So the point is like this. There is believing in God, and then there's internalizing and integrating one's faith until the extent that you know there's a God. And there's a very big difference.
Not necessarily understand God.
Well, we should try to understand as much as we can. Doesn't mean we fully understand God. That's why we, if you were part of our last course called My God, you'll know that we don't fully understand God, most certainly not. Then if we did, we would be God. But we should try to know as much as we can about God, not just rely on faith alone. And here's an illustration that the Talmud gives us, that there was this individual who was about to break into a house, and before he entered, he paused for a prayer to God that he should be successful in this act of robbery. So let me ask you a question. If this guy is praying to God to bless the work of his hands with success, does he believe in God?
Yes.
He does. If he didn't believe in God, he wouldn't stop to pray to God and ask for success. The question is, if he integrated his faith in God, if he really knows there's a God, no. Because if he did, then he would internalize the fact that God is the one who said, "Do not steal," and therefore you shouldn't do what you're about to do. And that's really the difference. You can have faith, but faith is like, or certainly can remain aloof. You can have faith and it could just be theoretical. I believe in God, but it's not part of me. You know, when Think about communism under Stalin. There were many Jews, in fact, the majority of Jews. I had one at my home, not this week, I was away, the Friday night before that, for dinner at my house. He grew up in Ukraine, actually. And he never did anything Jewish in his life. He knew he was Jewish, but that's about it, because you weren't allowed to. Because under communism, there was a threat of who knows what, and many people lost their life for observing Judaism. So the majority of Jews gave up, even religious Jews. But there were a few who held on to it at any cost. They refused to part from their Jewish observance, regardless of what it would mean. How would you define the difference? And we're not judging anybody here, of course, people who lived under those conditions. But what would one way of defining or describing or trying to understand the difference, why one person would be easier to let go of it versus the next? Because for one, they had faith in God. But the other knows there's a God. Just like Stalin is real, and you know that there is a real Stalin, there's also a real God. And when you know there is a real God, you're not so easy to just let go of it and let go of your observance just because it's a threat, because both of them are real. And that is a key aspect, and this is why Judaism does have a philosophy as well, because without it, we would just have faith, but possibly a faith that's distant. One more point from the text that we just read. Many people talk about the fact, just today, okay? I was scrolling on Facebook. I do a little bit of it, not too much. But I came across somebody from Houston who I don't really know personally. It's more like a social media friendship. But I see he's in Thailand. And he shows a video of him rapping tefillin with my colleague in Koh Samui, Thailand, like today over there. And he writes in the post that it was his first time ever rapping tefillin in his life. Just from looking at the guy, it's clear that he's somewhere between 65 and 75. First time ever doing it. Okay, beautiful mitzvah. But somebody left a comment on that video that he showed and said, "Oh, fascinating, I see you're rapping tefillin. You know, my grandfather had a set of those that he always had, but I never actually saw anyone wearing them. But I know he had them, but they were in his drawer for decades and decades. And he lived with us before he passed away, so I knew that he had them." What's my point? My point is that this woman never saw tefillin being used because they were her grandfather's. This verse here, which we actually say every day, and it comes from the song that was the song of the sea after the Jewish people went through the sea. What does it say in Hebrew? Ze keli ve'anvehu. Sounds familiar? Elokei avi v'arom emenu. It's right there in Az Yashir. What does it mean? It says, "This is my God, and I will beautify him, the God of my father, and I will exalt him." But the words are precise, this Jewish philosopher is telling us. That God can't be that I observe Judaism or I'm a Jew because my grandfather had faith or because my grandmother made a certain delicious Jewish food. That won't do it for me. I can't be Jewish on their account. I need to be Jewish because God is my God, not the God of my father or of my mother or of my grandfather or grandmother. That won't work. If it is going to be that, then the faith will just hover from above. It won't be integrated. I need to own my Judaism. This is my God. It's actually the name of a book. Anyone know about it? Anyone know the author? Herman?
Melville.
Wook. This is my God. Ze Keli. It's after these two words. Because that is what our relationship needs to be. It's not, I'm not doing it because someone else told me to do this, or just because it's tradition. I'm doing it because I developed my own relationship with God. How can I do that? Not when I just have faith. Faith alone won't cut it. Maybe in other religions it does. We have to take our faith and we have to integrate it. We have to develop and cultivate a knowledge and an understanding of God. And then when we understand it every part and aspect of our being becomes integrated with our divine and godly relationship. If it's only our faith, then our mind is left available to other things. If our heart is not involved, our heart is available for other things. That's why our mind and heart all need to be part of, immersed in this experience. You had a question?
Yes, so we know from our previous classes that you are not supposed to endanger a life, even your own. So if you're in a situation where by practicing your faith outwardly, you're putting yourself at risk, do you really, that's just contradictory to me.
Great question. I mentioned that just as an aside, but being that you're asking, I'll respond. First of all, there is a... It's true that you don't... We discussed last week, right? That you don't sacrifice your life, meaning for most of the commandments, you violate the commandments in order to preserve life, right? So number one, there's three exceptions to that. Last week, we spoke about one of the exceptions, and that is to preserve a life. So you don't kill someone else to save your life, not to get back into the discussion. But another one was for idol worship. So essentially, if there's somebody coming to you and telling you not to turn away from God and to worship an idol, you do not worship the idol. In those three instances, you have to be willing to sacrifice your life. Now, it goes beyond that, actually, that even with all the rest of the commandments, there are times when you have to give up your life even for an ordinary commandment that's not from those big three. And that is when the time is one, which is called in Hebrew, Bishas Hashmad. If there's a time when an enemy is coming at us and wants us to deny our Jewishness and our Jewish identity. So if somebody comes specifically and says to bow down to the cross or even something else, but there's like a campaign to get Jews to go away and turn away from their Jewishness, then even for something lighter, we have to be willing to lose our life. So that era certainly falls into that category. That's number two. Number three, one more point, and I'm just going to state it anyway, even though we're not going to get into it, and that is that maybe one isn't obligated to give up their life in such an instance. But for somebody who their Jewishness is at the very core of their life, then you can't separate it from them. If it's someone who can't even consider the thought of being separated from God and their Jewish identity, regardless of what the circumstance is, then what are you going to do? Force them to? Maybe they're not obligated to give up their life, but if they can't consider anything otherwise, what are you going to do? What is life if I'm going to be denying my Jewish identity and my relationship with God? So we'll leave it at that for now. One more point here, and that is, we talked about the fact that there are many commandments in Judaism that require us to get our mind and our heart involved as well, because there are mitzvahs that need our heart and they're emotion-based. Then we made the point, just to sum up, that in order to have a proper relationship with God, we can't just remain on a level of faith, but we need to actually integrate it and know God, not just have faith in God, like we illustrated with that thief about to break into a home who certainly had faith, but he didn't know God. And that's why he was willing to go ahead with this act of thievery. That was point number two. And point number three is that it's important to have a Jewish philosophy, because how do you develop feelings for something? How do you develop feelings, which are then going to produce the right behaviors. It all starts from the mind. Everything starts from the mind. So when we engage in Jewish philosophy and understand God, the ideas give birth to healthy emotions, which then in turn keep us on the right path of behavior. So I kind of alluded to this in the beginning, that we can't just rely on doing the right thing all the time. We have to back it up with the right ideas, which give birth to the right emotions.
When did philosophy integrate itself into Judaism?
When? So first of all, we're going to watch a video which is going to highlight important works of philosophy, and we'll see it in a second. But before we even do that, I just want you to know that it was in the 10th century, the first, and we'll see the details soon, but there were actual pragmatic reasons of why works of Jewish philosophy were written. Because earlier on, and kind of like we said even last week, in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, you have philosophical ideas, but you don't have exclusive works of philosophy during that era. Basically, the first official post-Talmudic work of philosophy was written in about the 10th century, I believe, by Maimonides, called in Hebrew Mora Nevuchim, which is translated as Guide for the Perplexed. And the reason why Maimonides wrote that work is because
he was confused himself.
He wasn't confused. He wrote it because Greek philosophy began to become very prevalent. And many Jews were studying that and becoming confused. So in response to that, Maimonides wrote his work so that people should be able to have a rational approach to Judaism as well. Not just a faith-based approach. As I said before, if all you're going to have is faith, your mind is going to be available to be attracted to other foreign ideas. So that's why we have to fill our mind with Jewish ideas. There's actually a well-known book. It's called Think Jewish. We have to think like a Jew. Very often, Jews in this country especially, because we live amongst many others of different religions and different philosophies, it's very easy for us to get caught up in other ideas. Now, of course, we can be integrated with other people, but we still need to have our own ideas. And we may even need our own ideas stronger than when we lived in the shtetl. When we lived in the shtetl, you just do what you need to do, and you're okay. But when you're exposed to many other ideas, then we need to have our own ideas down pat, much stronger than otherwise. And this is why Maimonides wrote his work. Because of that, it was a response to the access that people had to Greek philosophy at the time, and many, as a result, were challenged by what they saw as a contradiction between philosophy and their Jewish faith. That's why he and others wrote their works. And by the way, the ethical movement, the Musar movement, was a response to the Enlightenment movement. More recently, the Musar movement is a 19th century movement, which was started by Rabbi Israel Salanter, and this was in response to the Enlightenment. Again, Jews were becoming attracted to other ideas, and there was a need for Judaism to develop its own set of full-on approach to Jewish ethics, and that's where it came from. Okay. Let's advance here. And by the way, you do have in figure 5.1 major works of Musar and Jewish philosophy and the timeline of when they were developed. But we'll go on to the video and then we'll continue our conversation afterwards.
Spring water gushing with inspiring force, diverging into multiple rivers the further it travels, so do the Torah's wisdoms and insights branch into multiple streams of thought the further the Jews travel with it on their journey through time. Let's take a look at two of those streams, whose courses run parallel and often intersect. Musar, a Hebrew term for restraint or discipline, has been used since biblical times to refer to ethics, character cultivation, and spiritual self-improvement. Musar is the field of Torah psychology. Chakira, a Hebrew term for investigation, is used for the intellectual probing of Judaism's ideology and theology. Chakira is the field of Torah philosophy. These twin wisdoms are woven throughout the narratives and teachings of the Tanakh, including the Ten Commandments, which are diverse in genre. King Solomon drew extensively from their waters to compose the biblical book Mishle, Proverbs, which provides observations on human nature and guidance for an intellectual, moral, and righteous life. He also produced Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, on the meaning of life and human pursuits and the role of religion. Another biblical book, Iyov, the book of Job, investigates human suffering, the existence of evil, and the limitations of theology. Insights into Torah psychology and philosophy filter into the discussions of the Talmud. In fact, the Mishnah devotes much of the tractate Avos to ethical conduct. But the divergence into independent fields of Torah exploration, with scholarly publications exclusive to these two genres, occurred in the 10th century. At that time, the primary centers of Jewish life and scholarship were located in Arabic-speaking countries, where academia had flourished for centuries. For that reason, the initial works of Jewish ethics and philosophy were written in Judeo-Arabic. But in the 13th century, with the decline of Arabic civilization and the academic shift to Europe, Hebrew again became the primary language in which Jewish books were composed. Rabbi Sadia Gaon was a prominent rabbi and author who lived in Egypt, the land of Israel, and Babylon. His book, Beliefs and Opinions, is the earliest known organized presentation of Torah philosophy and theology. Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Gabirol of Spain wrote on philosophy, ethics, Kabbalah, and Hebrew literature. His Fount of Life is a classic in Jewish and Islamic ethical philosophy. Rabbi Bachya Ibn Pakuda of Spain penned the first systematic work of Jewish ethical philosophy that later inherited the title of its Hebrew translation, Chavot Halavavot, Duties of the Hearts. Its 10 gates explore unity of God, providence, worship, trust, sincerity, humility, repentance, self-examination, asceticism, and love. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi of Spain, one of Jewish history's greatest poets and liturgists, crafted Kuzari, one of Judaism's premier theological presentations, couched as a dialogue between an 8th century rabbi and a Khazar king who converted to Judaism. Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, the universally acclaimed Maimonides, produced Guide for the Perplexed while living in Egypt. The work leans on Aristotelian and classical Arabic philosophy to explain Judaism's fundamental principles. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid of Germany, a founder of the Hasidei Ashkenaz ascetic movement, wrote the ethical Sefer Hasidim, Book of the Pious. A brilliant but anonymous rabbinic author living in Barcelona produced Chinuch, Book of Education, recording reasons for each of the 613 biblical commandments with the ethical lessons they convey. Rabbi Yonah Garondi of Spain authored several moralistic works, including the famous Sha'arei Tshuva, Gates of Repentance. Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, known as Ralbag, or Gersonides, was a French philosopher, mathematician, astronomer, scientist, and inventor. He wrote a philosophical treatise, Milchamot Hashem, God's Battles, and a Bible commentary that drew philosophical, ethical, and legal conclusions from the narrative. Derashot Haran, the Discourses of Rabbi Nissim Garondi of Catalonia, explores elemental ideas in Jewish philosophy such as creation, free choice, prophecy, chosenness, nature and miracles, mitzvot, and Torah learning. An anonymous author published Orchot Tzadikim, Ways of the Righteous, a collection of ethical teachings that became a classic of the Musar Library. Rabbi Chiste Kreskas of Sargossa wrote Or Hashem, God's Light, to defend classical Jewish theology in the face of the Aristotelian philosophy favored by medieval Jewish scholars. Rabbi Yosef Albo of Spain penned a classic of Torah philosophy, Ikarim, Fundamentals, which emphasizes three pillars of Jewish belief: God's existence, the Torah's divine origin, and reward and punishment. Rabbi Eliyahu Davidas of Tzfat, a disciple of master Kabbalist Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, wrote a moral, mystical work named Reshit Chachma, Genesis of Wisdom. Rabbi Yehuda Lowy, known as Maharal of Prague, was one of the greatest sages of his era. Several schools of Torah philosophy are based on or derived from his many works. Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, or Ramchal, of Italy and Holland, authored many books on Kabbalah, philosophy, ethics, poetry, including an ethical classic, Mesilat Yesharim, Path of the Upright. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, a protege of the Vilna Gaon and founder of the Volozhin Yeshiva that produced several leading Torah scholars of the next century and a half, composed the philosophical and Kabbalistic Nefesh HaChaim, Soul of Life. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch lived in Germany and founded the Torah im Derech Eretz approach to Judaism, advocating a symbiosis of Torah learning with secular sciences and engagement with the modern world. He wrote philosophical and psychological insights on the biblical narratives, authored Horeb, a philosophical exploration of the mitzvot, and 19 Letters on Judaism, a work of philosophical defenses of the Jewish faith. Rabbi Yisrael Lipkin of Lithuania, known as Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, founded the modern Musar movement that invited fresh emphasis on ethical behavior, character refinement, and self-improvement in the European bastions of classical Torah study. Various schools emerged within this movement, including the Kelm School founded by Rabbi Simcha Zissel Ziv, which emphasized orderliness, thoughtfulness, and dedication; the Slabodka School of Rabbi Natan Zvi Finkel, focusing on the human striving for perfection; and the Novardic School of Rabbi Yosef Yozel Horowitz, which emphasized trust in God, humility, and self-effacement. The movement became a lasting cultural and educational phenomenon, drawing on earlier ethical classics while offering original contributions to the library of Jewish ethics. Many of its prominent rabbis emphasized specific methodologies. For example, its founder, Rabbi Salanter, focused on identifying personal strengths and weaknesses and confronting a weakness head-on. Rabbi Ziv emphasized thinking before acting. Rabbi Yosef Yehuda Leib Bloch taught Jewish philosophy-based ethics. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman focused on integrity of thought and belief. Rabbi Yeruchim Lavovitz focused on the uniqueness of each individual. Rabbi Eliyahu Eliezer Dessler's ethical and philosophical insights were colored by Kabbalistic and Hasidic teachings. His teachings are preserved in the Musar classic Michtav Me'Eliyahu, Letter from Eliyahu. Rabbi Shlomo Wolba focused on education and individual growth. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan of Radin, Belarus, a foremost halachist, ethicist, and mentor of 19th and 20th century Eastern European Jewry, is better known by the title of his first publication, Chafetz Chaim, Desires Light, a digest of laws relating to ethical speech. Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, modern Israel's first Ashkenazic chief rabbi, crafted works on Jewish thought and law with a distinctive philosophical, mystical, and poetic style. They are the ideological underpinnings for religious Zionism. Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik of Boston was a Talmudist, a philosopher, and a seminal figure of modern Orthodox Judaism. He led the rabbinical seminary at New York's Yeshiva University, and his philosophy was preserved in numerous articles and talks, including two landmark essays, The Lonely Man of Faith and Halachic Man. These are some of the primary works of Musar and Chakira composed throughout the centuries. The river of Torah flows on as sages and authors continue to expound new ideas, insights, and lessons from the Torah's timeless teachings.
How many of those were you able to read in Yeshiva?
On the spot, you're asking me. Well, you have to wait till next week, till Kabbalah and Hasidism, okay. And then I can give a much more informed answer. But I've read some of these, certainly, and a lot of the things I study pull information from these. Even if I didn't read the whole book, I will have studied sections from it that maybe are dealt with in other works as well. Lots of information, lots of great information. Hope you found that informative. All right, so with this, we will advance over to the next section of today's lesson. Any quick questions or comments before we do that? Yes, Sid?
So is there any, I'm going to use the word modern, but let's say within the last 50 years, so from the 70s to now, books on this.
Some of these were...
Well, I think the youngest man, he died in 35.
I think I saw one that died in 2005. Yeah, was that correct? Was I dreaming? Yeah. So there were, I mean, Rav Kook, for example, he's not the one until 2005, but he was a chief rabbi of the modern state of Israel. So some of these are more recent. And there are works that have been written since, but maybe they're not as prominent or haven't yet gained the prominence that these have.
Have these rabbis had their own schools?
Not all of them, but some of them. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Not every writer is a great teacher, by the way. Not every teacher is a great writer. So some of them were just writers, great scholars and writers, not necessarily that they have a school.
For whose sake, though?
For whose sake?
Yeah. I mean, there was a mass publication in the 10th century. So they wrote a book, Guide to the Codex.
Well, 10th century is 10th century, but this whole list was all the way till our modern times. But even in the 10th century, Maimonides wrote it, as we said, responding to a need. So at the time, his work, by the way, Guide for the Perplexed, was written in Arabic, by the way,
right.
Not in Hebrew, because it was for the purpose of people being able to relate to it and to study it, not just to be a holy book on the shelf. People needed it and needed to be accessible. Okay, so let's move ahead here. And like in past weeks, we're now going to actually do some studying together. So this is where this is the treat of tonight, and we're going to be studying a little bit of Jewish philosophy and a little bit of Jewish ethics, and we're actually going to tie it all together at the end. But we're going to be touching upon three ideas tonight, and that is creation, number one, number two, bitachon, which means trust in God, and number three, anger management. Okay, creation, bitachon, trust in God, and then anger. We'll explore these three topics through the lens of Musar and Chakira. Okay, so in order to do that, who can call out and tell me the first verse in the entire Torah?
In the beginning.
Keep going.
In the beginning.
Okay, that's the Hebrew, and we got the English. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That was everybody reading text number 4 together.
No.
So the question is, of course we all know this verse. The question is, what are the ideological implications of the statement? How does it relate to our emotional or mental state? What's the meaning of this? What's going on here? So let's go to text number 5. Where we have a very well-known comment by Rashi, who is the preeminent commentator of the Bible. And he's actually quoting from the Talmud when he writes this. So it goes back at least 1,500 years, as we know. And Sarah, I'll ask you to read, being that you are now on my right. Number 5.
The Torah ought to have begun with the verse, this month shall be to you, which is the first mitzvah commanded to the people of Israel. Why then does it begin with, in the beginning God created heavens and the earth?
Thank you. Very well-known question that Rashi asks. And he's asking a simple question. What is the Torah? The Torah, as we said before, is a book of laws. It's a book of mitzvahs, of commandments. Where does the first commandment appear? With the exception of circumcision for Abraham, but putting that aside, the first commandment, when the Jews were about to leave Egypt and get the Torah, appears in the portion called Bo. We read it a few weeks ago. And it is that the Jewish people should start keeping a Jewish calendar, should start counting the months. By the way, tonight is Rosh Chodesh. In that case, it was Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which is in a month from now. Tonight is Rosh Chodesh Adar. And that's the first commandment. So Rashi's question is, if this is a book of mitzvahs, why are you opening with creation and giving me this whole long Oiske Shlepte Maise about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his family till they get to Egypt and leave Egypt and get the Torah to tell us about the mitzvahs? Just cut out the whole book of Genesis, the first 2.5 portions of Exodus, and start the Torah from there, and we'll get straight down to business. It's a book of instructions. That's where the mitzvahs begin. Why are you giving me this whole long story for it? That's his question. And we're not going to get into the answer that he gives there, because it's not relevant tonight. And we have discussed it in previous courses. It's about the Holy Land, but it would go off topic here. What we're trying to do is get to a certain point, and that is how Nachmanides reacts to Rashi's question. And Nachmanides, we have this in text number 6, and this is what he says to after he studied Rashi on the first verse of the whole Torah. And he's like, what do you mean? What do you mean? What kind of question is that? Why we need the whole lengthy story and to start with creation? Of course we have to start with creation. Why is that? Colin, would you like to read text number 6, please?
The Midrashic teachings of Rashi cites in his commentary, but we can question this. Indeed, there is a great need to begin the Torah, with the beginning of creation, as this is the root of our faith. The one who does not believe this and thinks that the world always existed denies the very basis and has no Torah at all.
Thank you. So, do you get the question first? Our question is, Rashi's question is, what is the Torah? Is it a historical chronicle or a book of instructions? If it's a historical chronicle, then it's perfect. You start with creation. But that's not what it is. It's a book of instructions. So, you can skip the first and one third into the second book and start there. But what we just read from Nachmanides in text number 6 is his reaction to this question. It's actually very important to start with creation. Why is that? Because it's the source and the fundamental most fundamental aspect of our faith. And that is that God created the world. Because if we don't start with God created the world, and we believe that the world just always existed, and it wasn't created by God, then Judaism has nothing to stand on. The whole Judaism is pointless if we don't have that foundation that God created the world. So Nachmanides is telling Rashi, I don't even get your question. Of course we have to start with creation. And for this reason, because believing in creation as a beginning is a fundamental concept in Judaism. And this brings us to the difference in between the two different approaches or philosophies, we'll call the Jewish philosophy versus Aristotelian philosophy. Because what did Aristotle argue about creation?
That it's always been a universe and an earth.
That it's always been. There's always been. Now, he did acknowledge and believe in God, in a God, what he referred to as the prime mover, but he wasn't able to embrace the fact that the world was created. He couldn't logically accept that because In other words, the fact that he did believe in a God just meant that this God is part of the world. It's just the highest component within the world is God. But God didn't create the world. In fact, the world was never created. The world always existed. So this was his view of reality, which basically was embraced by everyone back then, besides for the Jewish philosophers who already 1,000 years ago wrote otherwise, namely Rabbi Sadia Gaon, Maimonides, Nachmanides. They all got up and said that Aristotle was wrong. He argued that the world always existed. But they came and said that not only there is a God, but God created the world. It didn't always exist. And this is what the first verse in the beginning of the Torah is necessary to be there for and to teach us that there is a God who created the world. And let's see what he says. Sid, would you like to read text number 7, please?
God tells us in the Torah that all things were created from nothing, created by him from a prior state of non-existence, as it is written. In the beginning, God created. That's Genesis 1:1. It also says, I am God who makes everything. Isaiah 44:24. This truth was corroborated for us with the signs and miracles. We therefore accept it. I then contemplate this truth, asking, can this be verified by logic, or is it verified by prophecy? I found that it is from a number of angles. The first proof is from the finiteness of the universe. Because we know that the heavens and earth are of limited size, their potential must also be limited as a finite object, cannot possess an infinite potential. Because the energy that sustains their existence is finite, they must have a beginning and an end. The second proof is from the particularization and complexity of the universe. I observe how every entity is comprised of interconnected parts and complex components, revealing to me the importance of their maker and creator. I found that this, too, is stated by the verse, when I see your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you arrayed. That's in Psalms 8, verse 4.
Thank you very much. So Rabbi Sadia Gaon, who was a 8th century sage and philosopher, so he wrote this. And what he's saying basically is, that's what he already wrote then. What limitless?
Yes.
Why do you say that?
His present knowledge is hundreds of millions of galaxies out there, and it's ever expanding.
That's not infinite. It's still finite.
We don't know yet.
It's still finite, as big as it is.
At the beginning of the day, we just thought it was us, and then it was us and the other 7 planets. And now there's so many galaxies and so many universes. I'm just saying, it's pretty much.
So many is still so many.
Still the number.
It's very,
exactly.
It's very hard.
Infinite is a different world. God himself and only God is infinite. But something that's finite, which is being created by an energy that's finite, has a beginning and has an end. And if it's finite and has definition, that means it didn't always exist. So it was created. And even though more recently, actually, this idea is being embraced, namely with the Big Bang Theory. Not that they are able to say who created it or how it was created, but that it does have a beginning and it didn't always exist. So the rabbis argued this already 1,000 years ago. But the question is, why does it matter which approach we take? Why is it necessary to go with what we're calling creationism versus the Aristotelian view? What's the difference? So you could take a look either at your... Yeah, actually, let's take a look right here. So if we take the approach of the Aristotelian view, then all miracles have a natural explanation. In other words, the Aristotelian view is that the world always existed, which means that it's just nature. And if it's nature, then regardless of what happens within nature and within the world, it's all just predetermined. It's not happening now because of a certain purpose. It's not purposeful. A miracle is not something that's outside of the box of nature in the Aristotelian view. It's just part of nature, and it could be explained away. It's not really a miracle. However, if you take the creationism approach for miracles, God disregards his natural way of running the world. But what the Jewish belief is that if God created the world and God created nature, he also overrides nature now and then. And that's what a miracle is. It's not just that it just happens because it's predetermined to happen that way. It's because God intentionally suspended nature to allow for a miracle to happen. Typically, water flows from high downward, and in one instance, the sea split and water stopped flowing the way it was known to do up until that point and from that point. Because at that moment, God performed a miracle and suspended nature. Similarly, our choices are all part of inborn nature. What value do our choices have if we take the Aristotelian view? If, again, it's just nature, all predetermined, what role do we play? Nothing, because there's no purpose in it. If the world wasn't created, then the world has no purpose either. Only if it was created could you say it was created for a purpose. But if it always existed, then A, it has no purpose. B, our role in it is insignificant. So our choices have no meaning. However, with creationism, we are created in the image of God and therefore can make our own moral choices. We are endowed with free choice. God created the world. God created us. And he also endowed us with the ability to make our own choices. But again, it's only if we follow this line of thinking. And finally, in the Aristotelian view, future change is all an outgrowth of the present reality. There's no hope for a better future, because whatever is going to happen tomorrow is just flowing from what happened today. We can't interfere, so to speak, or transcend what exists, because we have no ability to do so, and everything just flows from what was. However, the Jewish view teaches that our prayers and actions have the power to change the way that things are. So if the world was created by God and created for a purpose, and we were put here for a purpose, then we have the ability to change things. And the fact that something different happens tomorrow is because we may have played a role in making that change happen, not just because it happened just because it was a result of what happened before it. And it's all predetermined. So it actually makes a big difference in what way we go. And Maimonides tells us this in text number 8. Nick, would you like to read that one for us? A very important text.
The belief in a pre-existing world as viewed by Aristotle, in which everything that is must be, nothing changes its nature, and nothing acts contrary to its custom, this view contradicts the very basis of our faith, denies every miracle, and negates all that the Torah strives for or warns against. Know that with the belief of a created world, all miracles are possible. The Torah is possible, and all challenges to these truths are answered. For you should ask, why did God communicate his prophecy to this one and not to the other? Why did he command these particular mitzvot and prohibitions? What is the divine intent with these instructions? Why did God not inspire these actions and prohibitions in our nature, if this is the behavior that he desired? The answer to all these questions is, so God desired and so his wisdom deemed, in the same way that it was desired by God to create the world in this particular manner. But if we were to believe that the world is the way it is because it could not be any other way, then all these questions would necessarily arise, and they could only be answered with weak and unsatisfactory replies.
Thank you. So this was Maimonides in his work, Guide for the Perplexed. making the case that we just described, and that is that only according to the Jewish view could we make sense out of what happens in the world. But if we follow the Aristotelian view, then we're left with more questions than answers, because everything is a question. Because there's no reason why any one thing should happen more than anything else, or why there's nature, or why there was a miracle, or why there wasn't a miracle, or why this one served as a prophet and the other not. Because when God is designing everything, then we know that everything has a reason and everything has a purpose. So that's idea number one. A little taste of Jewish philosophy. Any questions? All good? Makes sense? Doesn't.
Would a prophecy that comes true, would that be considered a miracle?
I wouldn't say a miracle. I would call it a prophecy. but a prophecy, as we discussed in the first one or two classes, is God communicating. We also discussed it in the previous course. In my God, is God communicating to a prophet? And that's the word of God. But if we follow the Aristotelian view, then there would be no such thing. Because why would, first of all, who is God? And why would God even bother communicating to man? Because there is no purpose to it. Yes?
Seems like Aristotle's view could lead to some very catastrophic events. It kind of lacks humanity in the sense that, it could justify genocide. I think it could be taken to an extreme where people say, you know, this particular group of people are just terrible because that's their nature and we need to eliminate them.
Yeah, listen, you can't really ask any questions if you take that approach.
Right.
Meaning the fact that, you know, and I'm not going to get into this topic, it's of course a heavy one, but when somebody asks why did God do X, Y, and Z, just to ask that question means that that person's a believer. Sometimes they like to come across and say that I can't believe in God, because why would God do that? Or just crying out, why would God do that? That's not denying God. Only a believer can ask, why did God do that? If you don't believe in God, there's no one to even ask that question to. You're wasting your time. Because if you just take the Aristotelian approach, then there's no designer, there's no creator, there's no purpose. So who are you even turning to ask your question? It happened because it happened, because it's all predetermined, and you can't have an impact on anything, and whatever happens, happens, and that's it. That's why it happened. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's idea number one for tonight. Now let's advance to the second idea, and that is what we are calling bitachon. In Israel, this is the word for security. It's an important word to know for those going to Israel soon. Bitachon means security. But that's in modern Hebrew. But other than that, it means trust. Livtoach means to trust. Bitachon is the word that's known to mean trust in God. What does trust in God mean? Which is another major topic of discussion in the books of Musar and in Jewish philosophy. So trust is a very powerful instinct. A child trusts a parent, and we develop a trust, we trust people. And when trust is broken, it's a big deal. Someone who you trusted for a long time, that when there's a breach of trust, it really throws us off course, because it's a very powerful instinct. And it's one that we rely on. Now, what's the idea of trust? Once again, there's faith and there's trust, not to confuse the two. Okay? There's faith and then there's trust. The Rebbe would always highlight the fact that on the US dollar, what does it say? In God we trust. Trust goes way beyond faith. You can have faith in somebody, very nice, but when you have trust in them, it's a whole different story. What's the difference? Just as an illustration, there was somebody once walking a tightrope, and he, before he did it, before he walked across, he turned to the audience, the huge audience that was there cheering him on, and he asked, who thinks that I can do this? And everybody was said that you could do it, you could do it, and they were cheering him on. Awesome. Then he said, from all of you cheering me on, would any of you like to come on my shoulders? And nobody came forward. So maybe they had faith that he can do it, but they didn't trust. If they trusted, they would be willing to go on his shoulders as he did it. But not quite. There's another story I once heard about three women who went to Miron in northern Israel, which is the gravesite of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the author of the Zohar. We'll probably talk about him next week in our final class on Kabbalah. And all three of them were praying for a child. And in reality, one of them became pregnant and had a child in the months and the year after that. And they knew each other, so they, you know, kind of compared notes, why one merited and the others not. And it turned out that this one who did get the blessing, actually, after going to Miron to pray, she went out and bought a stroller for her child that will be born. In other words, all three of them had faith. But one of them took it a little bit further and actually had trust. And trusted that God would answer her prayers. And actually acted upon it. Because when you know it's happening for certain, then a child, the baby, needs a stroller. So it goes beyond just faith that we always hear about. That's what bitachon means. Now, if we have real solid trust in God, then it negates two other possibilities. One is, the first one that it negates, is what we're going to call self-reliance. Someone who trusts in God will not be someone who is self-reliant. What does that mean? What is the self-reliant idea? Let's take a look at text number 9, which is from Deuteronomy. Barbara, would you like to read, please?
Sure. Beware lest you eat and be sated, and you will build your houses and dwell therein. And your herds and your flocks will multiply. Your silver and gold increase. And all that you have will increase. And your heart will grow haughty, and you will forget the Lord your God. And you will say in your heart, my ability and the might of my hand have accumulated this wealth. Remember the Lord your God, as it is he who gives you the ability to make wealth.
Thank you very much. So what's happening here? So this first individual is someone who is self-reliant. And when it usually happens to someone who is doing well, and things are going well for them, and they're blessed, so that's when we often forget about God, because we don't need God at that point. Things are going well. I've told you the story many times, but every time I come from New York, I'm reminded of it once again, of the fellow who pulled up in front of his building in the evening, and it was raining, and he was looking for parking, and he couldn't find. But there he is, he's sitting in front of the building. He's, you know, typically if it wasn't raining, you just keep driving. I parked a full block away from the place we were staying a few days ago. But in the rain, it's not really such a good option. So there he is, sitting there, and he says, God Almighty, if a space opens up right here in front of my building right now, I promise I'm going to start going to services every single Shabbat. And I'm going to start eating kosher only, etc., etc. As he's saying that, a car lights go on and a spot is cleared right next to him. As soon as he sees that, he turns back to God and says, God, never mind, I just found one. Because when we're in need, then we know where to turn. But as soon as we don't need anymore, we're convinced that we are self-reliant and that it's our own smarts that brought us the blessings and not God. On the other extreme, we have another fellow. And this fellow is the fatalist. Somebody whose attitude is that whatever will happen. There's nothing I can do to impact anything. I can't make a difference. And everything's just out of my hands. We're just given to fate. So there's two different extremes here. And trust in God, bitachon, it does not align with either of these, as we'll see. It's distant from both of them. So what does that mean? So why is this second individual also wrong? So bitachon, trust in God. Everything in our lives is a divinely ordained purpose. The journey of life guides us toward that goal. The self-reliant person believes their success and failures are all due to their own efforts. So when things are good, they believe that it's their doing. And when it's not, nothing could have changed it. They failed, and that's it. The fatalist is carefree and sees fate as entirely out of their hands. And this, too, is the wrong approach. Because as text number 10 tells us, based on this verse, we have a comment which says that, I'm going to read text number 10, because it says, God will bless you. I might think that a person can sit idle because God is blessing me. So I don't have to do anything to get his blessing. So the Torah teaches, in all that you do, yes, God is blessing you, but he's blessing you in all that you do, which means that you have to do something for his blessing to take hold. Anyone ever hear the term that we need to create a vessel? What does that mean, to create a vessel? It means that we have to put in our own effort. It means that God gives us the blessing, but we have to create a space to receive the blessing. And that's why, well, if God is the one who is blessing me with my livelihood, maybe I should go sit on the couch and watch TV and wait for the check to arrive, if God's blessing me. But the second half of the verse says, yes, he's blessing me in the first half. But the second half says, in all that you do, you have to do something to create a space for God's blessing. So let me ask you, if we have these two components, God blessing us, let's just say with a livelihood or with health or whatever it is, let's focus on livelihood for right now. You have God blessing us, then you have what we do. So what we do is our job, right? You can't just sit back and do nothing, you got to do something. So you have a job, and your job creates the space for the divine blessing to dwell, to be received. So let me ask you, what's primary and what's secondary?
I think what you do actuates God's blessing. Because the blessing is waiting, but you have to create a space for it, right?
So which one is primary, which one secondary?
Well, I guess the blessing would have to be primary.
So the blessing is primary, and now I have to figure out how to receive the blessing. So I have to create a vessel, or set up a vessel. Okay, so let's understand this a little bit more. Before we do that, by the way, I just want to call your attention to this slide because it really brings home this point. Bitachon is the trust in God. Then we have the self-reliant person versus the fatalist. But neither of them, I want to be clear that trust in God is not aligned with either. It's distant from both. And we're spelling out why. Because, well, the first one, the self-reliant one, we already said that, of course, he's wrong because you're not the one making things happen, and because things are happening by divine design. But the other one is also wrong, because yes, God is the one that blesses us, but he does so on condition that we are involved. Basically, we're a partner in the process. By creating that vessel, that space, whatever our job or business is, that creates that space. Now, let's join me on page 207, please, on figure 5.4. Let's take a look at this, because it's a really good illustration of the point we're trying to make here. So what do we see here? We have a wheel with a bunch of barrels of water. And what's happening here? As the wheel turns, so the pitchers, the barrels of water are being filled up from the well. And then as they come up, they're being poured out and serving whatever purpose I'm using this water for, to irrigate and to produce, etc. So looking at this water wheel, what do we have here? So there's two components. We have the barrels. The barrels of water are what's bringing me the water from the well to my space. So the question is, where am I going to put all my energy? Of course, I'm going to make sure there are barrels there and make sure they're not broken, etc. But if I'm only going to focus on the barrels, then what happens when the well dries up? The well could dry up, or there could be no power turning this wheel, and then I'm not going to be getting any water from the source. So I can have the best pitchers, the best vessels, and I can add more and more vessels, but if the well dried up, I'm not going to be getting any water. So you can't lose sight of the source of where the water is coming from. So let's apply this analogy to our own story here. Let's say I have a business. If I view my business as the source of my wealth, okay, your business being in the analogy are like the pitchers, which are bringing you the water. So if my business is the source of my wealth, if all I know are the pitchers, then if I work harder, if I work longer days, I'm going to make more money. If I work 7 days instead of 6 days a week, then I'll make more money as well. And if I don't give 10% of my earnings to charity, then I'll have more money. If I look at the business as the source of my wealth, the more I put into it, the more I'm going to have. But that, this approach would be short-sighted, of course. This would be like somebody who's focusing only on the vessel, only on those pitchers, and not at the source where the water is coming from. If I'm only busy with the vessels, then the source could dry up and I'll be stuck without anything. What does this mean in the analog? What I have to realize, and what all of us need to realize, is that our business is only like delivering God's blessing to us. God is the source of our blessing, like the well is the source of the water. The pitchers are like the business that's bringing God's blessing to us. It's like the delivery system. So if my delivery system is constructed in a way that's incompatible with the source, okay, let's say for some reason these pitchers are not actually drawing water from the source, they're incompatible, I'm not going to get any water. So if my business is the way that God's blessing needs to reach me, if I'm not treating my business the way I need to based on God's will, then I'm basically creating a problem in the delivery. And God's blessing won't necessarily reach me. Because what's the true source of the blessing of my livelihood? It's coming from God. It's the business is just the delivery system. So this idea of bitachon that we're discussing here, trust in God, means that we focus in and realize where the blessing is really coming from. And we have to make sure that that channel is unobstructed. How do we do that? When we treat the business according to the way God would want us to. Then we're realizing where the blessing comes from, and the channel for the blessing to go from God to us is also going to be one that's going to work. Because we're treating it the way God wants us to treat it. How does that happen? What does it look like? So for a Jew, how do they treat their business? A Jew is never going to say, well, I'm going to work harder and I'm going to stay longer hours and I'm going to skip going to synagogue services as a result of being at work longer. Because that, if I do that, what am I saying? I'm saying that my source are the pitchers, not the well. If I think that by working longer hours, which are going to cause me to weaken my connection to God, or for example, if somebody's going to say, well, I'm going to work on Saturday as well because I'll have more business. But what they're saying is that we're missing the point. We're thinking that the blessing's coming from the business instead of from the source. We're making the pitchers primary instead of secondary, which is what's primary is really the well of water. Are you following me? Am I making sense here?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay. So that's the key here. That is the key. Let's just sum it up over here on the screen. So we have a vessel, of course, while the water wheel is a channel through which the water is transported, both the motor and the well are needed for it to work properly. It's not a working entity on its own. When one focuses on the vessels and not on the resource itself, God, then the delivery system will be incompatible with the source. Bitachon, trust, directs us on how to become worthy of divine blessing. So becoming worthy of divine blessing is by creating a channel that actually works. I'm not going to read text 13. It's a great text. I think it should be read. And it really gives you a perspective of when somebody does trust in God, how they go about their life and everything that they encounter and what they attribute it to, both the good and the less than good. But with that, we'll go over to our third and final idea for tonight, and that is anger management. Any quick questions or comments? I guess everyone wants the tips for anger management. All right. Okay. So how do we deal with this? This is, of course, a big one that's dealt with in Jewish ethics. As a rule, in Jewish ethics, we're taught that when it comes to temperament and character, the masters of Musar tell us to follow the golden path and to always take the middle path, to stay away from extremes, like not to be stingy, but not to be someone who just dumps their money on the floor. That's the other extreme. You need someone who's level-headed, and you take the middle approach. You're generous, you give charity, but you also have to have money to support your family. You can't give 100% of your money to charity. That would be irresponsible. So you need a healthy path, and that's true in most characteristics and character traits. Like Jacob, would you like to read text 14? This is also from Maimonides. Please, on page 212. Page 212, text 14. Kim, want to continue with 15, please?
Building a character is like cooking a stew. You need greens and meat and water and spices and salt. Too little meat in the broth is thin, too much salt and it's inedible. But when an expert takes from each in the right measure, then the food will be tasty and pleasant for the one who eats it. So too with the traits of the human character. There are traits of which one should avail oneself in large measure, such as humility and bashfulness and the like. And traits that should be employed only minutely, such as pride and brazenness and cruelty. One who carefully weighs and measures the amount to be taken of each trait will achieve goodness.
Thank you both. So the right approach is to have the right amount, just the right amount. You know, when you have a good challenge here on Shabbat after services, and it's just perfect, and you ask the chef how much you put in, she doesn't know.
I asked
a little of this, a little of that.
That's exactly what she said.
Got to be. And then it comes out perfectly. But there's got to be the right balance of everything. Too much of one thing, and then the whole chalent is gone. And the same is when it comes to character traits. It's important to have the right balance. Extremes are usually not good. But here's the exception. The exception is when it comes to anger. When it comes to anger, as Maimonides tells us in text number 16, I'll read this one. There are certain traits regarding which a person should not conduct themselves in an intermediate manner, but should distance themselves to the other extreme. For example, anger is an extremely negative trait from which a person should distance themselves in the extreme and train themselves not to get angry even over things that are worthy of anger. The early sages said, and this is a big statement, we'll talk about it, one who gets angry, it is as if they worshipped idols. They also said, one who gets angry, if they are a wise person, their wisdom departs from them. If they are a prophet, their prophecy departs from them. Those who are prone to anger, their life is not a life. The sages therefore instructed to distance oneself from anger. This is the good path. So, if we said about everything else that we should take a balanced approach, what is it about anger for which we're saying to go to the extreme and make sure not to have even an iota of it.
Are you talking about irrational anger or anger with the cause?
You said irrational?
Yeah. Or
with the cause?
Causational anger, yeah.
I mean, when it comes to, you know, when it comes to, let's just say, educating a child, the same Maimonides does say that a teacher or a parent should or could, if necessary, if they need to teach a child, they need to make a point, they could, so to speak, give off an angry
demeanor.
But when they're done making the statement or making the point that they need to make, they should turn around and be returned to their normal balanced state. In other words, for someone to lose their temper is absolutely never okay. Anger, when the anger owns us, that's never, never good. But when we use anger for very specific purposes, that could have value. And I doubt that that's ever the case or ever the right thing to do when it comes to adults among other adults or between loved ones, when it isn't a child that you need to teach an important life skill or a child that ran into the street or whatever. Generally speaking, it should be avoided at all costs. And the Jewish ethicists write at length about it, and they share all kinds of techniques of ways to actually stay away from it. The question is only, what does it mean that one who gets angry is as if they worshipped idols, which is a pretty big statement? What's the connection between idolatry and anger? Anybody?
It's not holy, it's not sacred. It is moving away from being godly.
Yes, yes, yes. Anyone have a few more words? Why is it moving away from being godly? Here's the key.
Got angry twice.
First of all, we dealt with that in last course, and my God. So you should have shown up. But in one line, God didn't get angry that the angry owned him. God used anger. And what we said in that course is that by God showing anger, he's actually showing us that he cares about us. If someone gets angry at you, it means they're not indifferent. If you do something and you're not angering them, it means they don't even care about you. So by God showing anger, he's actually showing us that he cares. But not to digress, why is anger like worshiping idols? Let's conclude with text 17 today. Very important, very big idea. We'll come back to our start right here. Sarah, could you please read that? And this is from the Tanya, Rabbi Schneer Zalman.
Of the statement is that a person will get angry only because at the time of their anger, their faith has departed from them. For if they were to truly believe that what happened to them came from the Almighty, they would not be angered at all. Although a human being possessed of free choice has cursed them or struck them or damaged their property, and this perpetrator is indeed culpable for punishment, both by human courts of law and by the heavenly court for the evil of their choice. Nevertheless, the hurt that one has suffered had already been decreed from above, and God has many emissaries to carry out his will. Furthermore, even in the very moment that this person is striking them or cursing them, this person is being granted existence and life by the divine utterance and vitality that is constantly being invested in them.
Thank you. Let's unpack this big idea here. So again, anger is being compared to idol worship. What does that mean? If I'm angry at somebody because somebody did something to me, okay? If I was trying to pull into my parking spot at HEB and somebody zipped right into it before me, and you get out of your car and you start screaming at them, what am I doing? What I just did was basically, I just gave power to that person to decide what happened to me. I moved the power away from God and gave it to that person. In other words, that's idol worship. What does idol worship mean? It means attributing control to something outside of God. That God is not the only entity or only being in control, but to someone else or something else that's in control. When I'm getting angry at somebody, it means that I am attributing what happened to me to them and not to God. That's why it is a subtle form of idol worship. And the key here, when we say that we should avoid anger at all costs, is because how essential and how fundamental of a character trait this is. Because what we need to realize that whatever happens is God's will. And it's never that person who did something to us. It wasn't their will for it to happen to us. And to clarify, because there's a little paradox here. It doesn't mean that I could go do whatever I want to another person and say, well, God willed it. It's not me, it's God. That would be missing the point. When something happens to us, then I need to view it as if God ordained that it should happen to me. That doesn't mean that person's unaccountable to God. They are. They are accountable for offering their services to God. So God decided that something needs to happen to me. But how's it going to get to me? For somebody to make the decision to be the one to deliver it to me, they're making the wrong decision. And they are going to have to pay for that. But the fact that it happened to me, that has nothing to do with that person. And getting angry at them is turning what happened to me away from God and crediting another source to be the one who was in control of that thing that happened. And therefore, it's something that we need to stay away from to the extreme. And just to bring all these three ideas together, okay, let's sum it up here. And with this, we will close. So just to catch up here. So with anger, we set an exception. With anger, we are taught to go to the other extreme and avoid it completely. When one gets angry, it's as if they worshipped idols. So what exactly is happening here to bring it all home? What is creation? We first discussed creation, which was the bitachon mindset, which is going to bring all these three ideas together. When it comes to creation, we said that God was doing it, and we negated the Aristotelian view that there's no creator to the world and there's no beginning to the world. The Jewish belief is that there is a creator and there is a beginning and there is a purpose. So God's creation is purposeful, and as the creator, he is ultimate goodness. And we have that sense of trust in God, that whatever happens is God's goodness. So all that he does is ultimately for the good, and we only control what we choose to do, and we conclude with the idea of Joseph and his brothers, and he actually communicated exactly this to his brothers after revealing his identity to them by saying that it is not you who decided that I should be here, when they were afraid that now that he was in control, he would take revenge of them. What did he say to them? That, I'm sorry, you may have had bad intentions, but God had good intentions. And God is the one that orchestrated that I should be here in this time and this place so that I can serve this specific purpose. So with that, we close this class, lesson number 5. Thank you for joining, and don't miss the grand finale next Monday evening to discuss the highlight of the whole course, Kabbalah and Hasidism. And with that, you will become certified book smart. Thank you very much.
Thank you.